This is a podcast from Cambridge International Examinations. For further information, visit cie.org.uk.
I've been looking forward to this very much. I had a preview of Neil's presentation and, in a sense, his reflections, I think, on his own personal journey, which from the programme you can see that Neil has got a rich range of experience in different continents and so on. I could say, actually, it seems to me that Neil has sailed the seven seas, really. And I said to Neil, also reading what he's going to say to us, it seemed to me like a very serendipitous life, really. There's a lot of serendipity that he has had in his life. And serendipity is not simple luck. Of course, serendipity is about sailing on the sea and looking, exploring and inquiring and looking for new experiences and new places and new people, as it were. Because serendipity derives from Serendib, which is one of the names of Sri Lanka, the kind of paradise isle. So you're journeying in life to find such a place. And through that journey, you come across other places and other experiences. So over to Neil for his personal reflections.
Here we are. Good afternoon. Can you hear me clearly? I tend to boom sometimes, but that's all right. This is not the prime spot in a conference. It's almost the last keynote presentation, and much of what I will say will probably have been said already. So you're sort of busy looking at your notes, thinking, what can I cut out and what can I put back in and so on. The other thing is that it seemed like a good idea to present this afternoon 6 months ago. When it came to the point of coming to the conference and travelling from Thailand and getting all the flight connections, it seemed less of a good idea. But now I'm here, I'm quite delighted. There's just one thing I want to say. Before I came, Cambridge, in their wisdom, contacted me and said, before you come, we'd like to see your presentation. And it caught me unawares, because I have a day job running a school. If you run a school, you know what that's like. And they said, we want the presentation by the 5th of September. So I spent the next 2 days writing stuff up because I don't have a series of PowerPoint slides. I don't have a drawer full of slides on school as leader. And so I was stuck. So I wrote. And do you know how many words there are in a one-hour lecture or whatever this is called? Lots of words, believe me. Anyway, I made the deadline. I sent it off to them. And it came back with a few suggestions. I'm still running my day job, doing that plate, then this plate. I've got an accreditation visit in a week, doing that plate. Board meeting, doing that plate as well. Anyway, I've done the presentation. I've fiddled with it. I corrected it. I brought it in. There's a lot of words. And it's not terribly interactive. You're stuck. You're going to listen to me. Now, that might be a good thing normally on the first lecture, the first presentation. On the last one, it could mean that you've got the opportunity to snooze. But I'm watching you. I will track you down at the end of this. So excuse me if I seem to read. Every now and again, I'll get a flash of blinding inspiration, and I'll break off, and I will say something. It will sound inspiring to me, probably not to you, but that's tough. We all know that when we are in a conference, you take what you get. And so I'm just making all the excuses before I start. However, I would like to say it's a great pleasure being here. I've never been to a conference where so many people shouted out answers to things so willingly. I don't do that. I'm British. This is a personal journey. He's back to center stage here. This is a personal journey. And I come to you with no great profound theory. I've learned a lot over my career around many different countries, many different cultures. And I think that I've developed a cultural sensitivity wherever I've been. Wherever I've gone, I've always been me, British. Welsh, actually. You may have noticed a little twang. I've always been me. I've been Welsh. And I found that wherever I've been, if you can respect the person you're with, they will respect you. You do not need to try and be something that you are not. I've never tried to do that, and I've always seemed to get on wherever I've been. So I've led a very, very privileged life. Very privileged. I can't tell you how wonderful it's been. It's had some moments, like now. It's had some moments, but those moments are learning experiences and they make a person stronger. And I think that's true for all of us as we go through life's journey. Anyway, this is it. I'll start now. Okay, as I just mentioned, I spent my entire career in international schools. I'm aware that some of you are from national school systems. And I've developed that sensitivity to the community in which my school has been located. One of the things about international schools is that many of the parents are expat. They do not have their culture around them. And because of that, the school becomes a very, very important part of their lives. It's the common reality that they have. In that sense, the school is the community. And once upon a time, I think schools reflected communities far more than they do today. Schools are embedded in communities, and I want you to consider that as I go through this afternoon's talk. Schools are embedded in communities, and some of them really depend upon the school itself. On top of that, my community, my school community, was embedded in a host culture and nation. And that also developed a particular sensitivity towards others. We had to be very, very careful what we said and what we did and how we were, how we behaved. I'm now going to take out my violin and say, being a head is a difficult job. People often don't like you. I don't know why. When you work with people and you're the boss of people, it's very hard to get too close to them. When you're in a community of parents, it's very hard not to get too close to them as well. In fact, it can be a very lonely position. I remember walking down the street. I worked in Japan for a while, and there's a long street called Motomachi. And I don't know all the parents. And so I'm like a nodding dog going down that Motomachi. Any foreigner I see, I nod in case they're parents. And I can imagine so many tourists going to, that's a weirdo walking down there. He's going around, just nodding away like a nodding dog. Anyway, those are the sorts of communities that I'm used to. So if you're not in a community just like that, you should still, however, think about the community that you are actually embedded in. The educationalist John Abbott refers to the three-legged stool of education. And I don't think we've really expanded on that sufficiently. Every child is educated by the school, but more importantly by the parents and the home, and also by the community. To take any section of that away, and we are not truly educating the child. We also know that children learn anyway. You know, we don't teach them how to learn, they're learning constantly. They learn bad things if we don't do it well. They never stop learning. That's why the brain is the way it is. And so wherever we are, whatever we do, however we respond to children, they will learn from it. And if we're really aggressive with them, they will learn from that. And the younger they are, the more that's going to be ingrained inside them. We have a tremendous responsibility to respond well to the children that we serve and service. So schools are given the formal task of educating our young people. But learning cannot be straitjacketed within the walls of a school or packaged by a well-constructed timetable. Conversely, I would suggest schools themselves cannot abrogate their responsibilities at the gate. They can't shut off their responsibilities and walk away. Job done. We can't do that. And I would argue the obligation extends to taking a leadership role in the communities that are served. The school as leader is neither a passive nor a reactive position. You can't just sit there and wait for things to happen, and neither should you wait until something happens and then respond. If you're going to be a leader, you have to take proactive steps and measures. And it doesn't matter really whether the school is in a national system, in an international system, in Timbuktu, or in Cambridge. And any school that, and anybody working within the school, I think, should be very aware, very sensitive to the community at large and also to the parent body. I'm going to put a few things because I have got PowerPoints. I can use these things, not very well. It's still like magic to me, this. Do you know what I mean? I just go, shh. I want you to consider these things. I want you to consider the characteristics of the communities that are represented by your school. You see, we don't live in a community. We're part of multiple communities. The educational community, the community of parents, the community of civil, whoever, officers, the community of the kids outside the school who are not inside the school. All of these people are part of our community. And I want you to consider your communities and what are the issues in those communities. Because you can ignore them at your peril. If the school is going to be meaningful, that school must understand the communities that surround it and interact with it. And how is your school able to impact in a positive way upon those communities? Or do you just close the door and send people out on service opportunities, bring them back in? How can you interact with the communities? And the key thing here is as a school, not with your children, not with the odd teacher, as a school. I want you to consider those questions as I go through this reflection. And now I'm going to shut them away. I hate people reading when I'm talking. Because you have that habit, you keep getting drawn to that. You know that the human brain is attracted by light. So instead of looking at me, you'll be looking at that all the time. So I don't like doing that. Leadership, like the word international, has always seemed to me to be mired in confusion. And while the concept of internationalism is continually morphing and was occupied research papers for the last 50 years, we've now got new terms, global citizen. So things like internationalism are moving on. And leadership is like that. If we are to debate its merits, we need to define it as best we can or attempt a definition. The school as leader adds another dimension to the concept of leadership, of just the whole concept of leadership. The school as leader is an institutional response to that, and that adds another layer of complexity. And I'm going to show you a coat of arms. Before I do, remember that saying by Churchill about the Soviet Union? He said the Soviet Union was like a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. And I think leadership and everything around leadership and internationalism is a bit like that. My current school, like many schools around the world, has leadership as part of what it does. Take a look at this. This is a great coat of arms. Look at that one. That's a really bold claim, or not. I'm not quite sure. That's my current school coat of arms, Leaders for Tomorrow. It's like leadership wrapped in internationalism inside an institution. What does it mean? It's as difficult to understand as Churchill's description of the Soviet Union. No pressure on me then. It's going to be easy. As you can see, it has what was once termed a motto. But in these days of product branding, I'm more reliably informed that it's a strapline. In fact, I heard the term strapline used today. When I was in school, they were mottos. But now they're straplines because we moved on. The world is moving. Leaders for Tomorrow seems to have just about the right amount of ambiguity to mean almost nothing. Or perhaps everything, depending upon your definition of leadership or how you got out of bed in the morning. In terms of a school mission, perhaps nothing more than a truism. There will be leaders. Some will come out of school at some time in the future. And some will fit just about any definition of leadership that we choose to use. It's astonishing to think that we are inclined to believe that leadership is always a positive attribute. We talked about assumptions earlier on. Leadership as a positive attribute all the time. the 20th century history books are full of leaders who are absolute disasters. Absolute disasters, but great leaders. They knew how to lead, they knew how to convince, they knew how to get followers. And our school corridors are full of leaders of various descriptions, strolling up and down. I do it occasionally. Okay, so it's we have this tacit assumption that leadership is always imbued with virtue. I'm going to come back to that word. I think virtue is a very, very important word. It was first used by the Greeks in terms of their education. It's a word that's dropped down the back of the sofa in our educational terminology. Virtue doesn't pop up often enough as far as I'm concerned. Lots of other words do, but virtue disappears. Once it was absolutely everything to do with education. In the Western Greek model, it was everything. So where did it suddenly go? I have to keep coming back. I can't read from over there. Leadership, whether individual or institutional, must have a context. And it seems to me that after 20 years as a head, that schools are becoming far scarier places. I look back nostalgically to the time when a fax really threw everything into consternation in the office. A fax. What is so urgent, so demanding, that this fax has come through and stopped me in my normal day's reflections? I have to respond to it. It's like a telephone call. You have to respond to it. Well, today my emails are incredible. They are long, so many emails, and I'm not very good technologically, so I leave a few. Did you ever do that? Please say you do. I'm not the only one. You leave a few to come back later, don't you? And then a few more add on, it goes down, and a few more add on, it goes down. They're right down the bottom, they've disappeared. And if you ignore them long enough, the problem goes away. But if it doesn't go away, if you haven't answered, there's another email the next day. Believe me, parents are very good at slapping the old email at me a second and third time. Anyway, they're very scary places, schools, with all the technology that's going on. But you can't put leadership and technology together. Institutional leadership, school as leader, is not about how good we are with the technology. In fact, technology and schools and leadership shouldn't go together, because we're always in schools trying to play catch-up with home technology and the ability of our students. So leadership, as far as I'm concerned, has got nothing to do with being out there surfing the crest of the technology wave or trying to be in front of anything. I need to make that clear, and I'd like you to reflect on that. And then we must prepare our students, as we and they have been told endlessly, and here we've been told the same thing, for jobs that don't yet exist, for a world that is changing rapidly, using technology that has become obsolete by the time it arrives in our schools. We have to get up before we go to bed. Leadership is not easy when we are scrambling to keep up, so we need to be very clear in our own minds what leadership means when we apply the term school as leader. Down the road from my school, perhaps no more than 5 kilometres, is a relatively new school. And technology works again, and there it is. Look, it's just down the road. I don't think we provided the inspiration for this, but you see that in market terms, and schools are businesses, the term leader is very, very important. It's used often. You probably use it in your documentation. I don't know, but I suspect it's in there somewhere. This whole conference is about leadership. It's a positive attribute. So schools use these terms quite frequently. I think what upsets me more than anything else is that we use terms without really understanding what we mean by them. And as a head, that has really irritated me more than anything else. And I'll come back to that and tell you my story about dealing with that last one, Leaders for Tomorrow. My school has a second strap line. We haven't got one, we've got 2 strap lines. It's really good. And this one I like a lot. It's learning about learning, metacognition. It's a fantastic strap line. I hate the term, so that's why I use it so. And when I arrived at the school, and I've only been there a year, I got my senior management together and I said, okay, because I'm really interested. Leaders for tomorrow, I didn't know what it meant, just fluff. But learning about learning, I was very, very focused on. So I said to them, this is my head of secondary, head of primary, deputy head, deputies of both sections, and the TIE director that I've got. And I said, okay, tell me about learning. What do we do? It was like that. It was silent. I said, how does it manifest itself in the school? Silence. I'm getting worried now. I went out. I said, if I go out into the corridor, what would I bump into? It would tell me learning about learning was taking place. This was getting absurd by this time because I was so irritated. Nobody knew what was going on. It's a strap line. It's on everything that we use. And my senior administrators could not tell me what it meant or how it was applied in the school. And then somewhat sheepishly, the head of primary said, well, actually, 5 years ago, we had an accreditation. And we thought it sounded pretty good. So we slipped it in. You can imagine how disappointed I was to hear that. But how many of us slip things in because they sound good all the time? We do it all the time, constantly. That's not leadership, by the way, at all. The problem for me is that these two strap lines should actually mean a tremendous amount. And a useful first step would be for the institution that uses them to have some idea of exactly what the meaning is and to accept responsibility for the claims that are made and to be held accountable for them. To be held accountable for them. When we're held accountable for something, then that makes us do the thing properly. But we seem to use words too glibly without allowing ourselves, first of all, to be responsible for them and then to be held accountable to them. And if we're going to be schools as leaders, you can't do that. We were talking today about how important it is that we use words correctly, that we communicate well. And if a school is going to adopt a leadership position in a community, all its communications must have a real purpose. And I'd ask you to reflect on your own statements about what you are, what you believe. And are you actually applying those things? I think this is a dilemma for all our schools and educators. In a highly competitive world, we're in danger of using words solely for their marketing potential. For their marketing potential. Without careful consideration of what the words actually stand for. Over recent years, I've been increasingly involved in discussion concerning branding of schools and organizations because perception, it seems, is all. And so branding is something that's come into our educational world in a big way. When I prepared these slides, I was using the brand Cambridge, and I had to use certain things to make sure that they conformed to that brand. And this is not a criticism. This is the way that the world goes. And when we as schools are developing our brand, if you like, we are full of slogans and ideas. Be very careful what you say, because you should really live up to what you claim. Slogans, like sound bites, are not really meant to inform. They're meant to reassure or to persuade. And in their use, I fear, we're in danger of devaluing our own professional language. I think that's important to understand. We're in danger of devaluing our own professional language if we use phrases like learning, about learning, and they have no meaning. When we actually want to start using them, people will say it's fluff. They've been around a long time. No one is comfortable with jargon, that professionally exclusive language for which familiarity has bred contempt. I believe that a certain precision with language and meaning is a necessary prerequisite for the school as leader. Does a school understand its own claims? Does a school live up to its claims? A school as leader must be able to articulate its values and be held accountable for them. Being a market leader, I would suggest, is not necessarily the same thing as being a leader. And yet so often, we're concerned about being a market leader in schools. Is it possible that we could run the risk of being a leader of markets? Or even worse, leaders of marketing? Hence, I hope the somewhat ironic and irreverent title of this address, Been There, Bought the T-Shirt. And you'd be wondering to yourself, what does he mean by that? So, here we go. I sometimes feel that members of school communities are overstressed and too hurried travellers in a too familiar landscape. Hitting the key sites, ticking off the boxes, buying into the slogan to remind themselves of where they've just been, identifying with the brand, and in so doing, absolving themselves of any responsibility for it. These slogans, these strap lines, what you write down, you are all of you, and the headmaster, particularly, or the head of a school, responsible to live up to those claims. As many of us in the international education are aware, business is booming. Business has never been as good as this in education. I shouldn't be using the word business, but boy, is it a business. It's a good business. We're in serious danger, I suppose, of demand for quality teachers exceeding by a large margin the supply, and this will impact on national as well as international systems in the future. The following information is from the International Schools Consultancy, which is based in Australia. This is the way of international schools, and even national schools will be impacted by this. In the last decade, the number of international schools has more than doubled, growing from 2,584 to 5,000 by May 2011. A further doubling is expected to take place by 2020. That's a huge increase in international schools. I think actually that's been conservative. China alone intends to build 3,000 Chinese-controlled international schools. And they're going to want international teachers. Do the math. More than half of the world's international schools are now based in Asia, and 2/3 of all new schools are being built on that continent. So many of us are from Asia at the moment. Competition's going to get tough. We've got a lot of people, but I'm not sure if they've got a lot of money. In 1980, when I first... it wasn't quite first. I'm a little older than that. But in my early years of teaching overseas, 80% of international school students were expatriate. Today, 80% are locals in international schools. It swung around, really swung around. And international schools consultancy figures show that almost all newly opened international schools in 2009 were for-profit organizations. That's a big change from how early international schools were set up. There's a dramatic impact on the world in terms of international schools, international education. And now there's a growing tension between the traditional idealism of the early international schools and the pragmatism of the current movement. And there's nothing wrong with that. Please, I'm not knocking any school as a business. As a head, I've been involved in the business side of schools for years. And you have to make an operating result or you'll go bankrupt. And that's not going to do anybody any good at all. But the market is growing. The pressure is increasing. I think this last... We haven't got it there. I'll go back. The last point is, really, I think they need about 250,000 more teachers in education in the next 5 to 10 years. 250,000. Where are they coming from? My daughter's one. My other son's one. My first son's in China teaching. And my second son is about to finish a degree in teaching. My wife's a teacher. My sister's a teacher. My brother-in-law's a teacher. I know, it's sad. What really, more than anything else, the fact that my four children want to become teachers, I hope it's not because the holidays are good, although they are good. And I hope it's not because they can travel the world, because you can travel the world. But I think they actually feel that that's worth doing. It's extraordinary. I actually think it's the best job in the world. In many cultures, there are words like sensei, guru, they mean more than teacher. When I went to Japan, I was given on my visa the term instructor. I was really offended. But the Japanese didn't dish out sensei that easily. You know, that's something special. So I was an instructor. Not good. It really irritates me even now I think about it, but it's really, yeah, you can see what I mean. So teaching is a fantastic, fantastic profession. I don't need to tell you that, but I did. I'd better cross those off, otherwise you'll be reading them all the time. As it happens, my own school produces T-shirts. We produce them by the bucketful. Every occasion, sports tournaments, community service, art exhibitions, concerts, charity events, we produce a T-shirt with slogans and spelling mistakes. That's a disaster. Never produce a T-shirt with a spelling mistake as a school. A disaster. I've done it. In a very real way, our identity has become diffused and confused. And in the larger scheme of things, perhaps, so too is our sense of purpose. And without purpose, I would suggest there can be no truly sustainable leadership, purposeful leadership. However, of course, there will always be followers. It could be argued that leaders can only be defined through the existence of followers. The concepts can only exist as a pair. Up can only exist with down, leader with follower. I'm reminded of that seminal, and I think 1960s book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, where Robert Persig, in his quest for quality, suggests that it can only really be defined by its absence. And I wonder if this is the same true for schools as leaders. You know, if it's not there, you notice it. You don't notice it when it is there. And that's the thing about leadership. You're not going to get any plaudits for it. If you do this thing properly, nobody's going to come and slap you on the back and say, good job. Don't do it, and they may come and tell you, what are you doing? Where's the quality? School is leader, what's going on? Learning about learning, where's that? I approach this presentation from a very practical perspective. I've been there, done that, and bought the T-shirt in several locations. And as a result, I just want to share some of those reflections. I'll speed up a bit because I can see the time ticking on, but you've been very good so far. I've been ahead for over 20 years. That's a long time, and in four different schools. I've got to hide the thickness of a rhinoceros. I really have. Because so much comes at you over the years. I'm old enough now not to care too much. And the best approach I can take to this concept of school as leader would be to examine how each in school has influenced my own professional approach and my own philosophy, if that's not too grand a word. And how I, with no particular articulated agenda in mind, attempted to do something with each of those schools, because that's what we do as heads. We get a school, we've got to do something with it. You don't just keep it going. You want to do something. All of you want to do something. You're all going to go back to school and change them in some way, we hope. I'm not convinced that anyone sets out to become a leader. There has to be a context for leadership to blossom. And being appointed to a leadership position does not confer divine right upon anyone. And this came as something of a surprise to me in my first headship position. Nobody said really nice things about me. They just threw problems at me. I learned very early on that I was there to clean up after everything. It's okay. I don't mind. I'm not convinced. I did that bit. I'll move on. Yes. We've all heard the aphorism, and this is an important one. I'm surprised it hasn't come up here, that managers do the thing right, and leaders do the right thing. And that's quite an interesting and important one, I think. The slide from leader to manager, and possibly failed manager, can be swift, unexpected, and extremely painful when it happens. Leadership is that greasy pole that we all attempt to climb. But on the other hand, we must behold the tortoise. He never gets anywhere without sticking his neck out. And that's what we have to do all the time. We know that, and we're prepared to take the consequences of that. My first school was in Lesotho, And it was surrounded when I was when it was built by a sea of apartheid. And when I was there, Mandela was still locked up on Robben Island. So my first school headship was in a country where the school was the only multinational, multicultural school in the gut of South Africa. That country had more embassies than just about any other. It had the EU Commission. It had a special relationship with the EU because everybody in the world was trying to make a point. EU were funding scholars for the school. My school is called Machabeng International. And then as soon as Nelson Mandela was released from prison, they all shut up shop and went somewhere else. And I was left to struggling to try and find funding for the school. It was an interesting place. It was founded in 1977, and it was established to make a statement. Some embassies there literally bristled like hedgehogs with surveillance equipment. It attracted ANC-connected families. Chris Hani, for example, the assassinated leader of Umkhonto Wesizwe, the spear of the nation, sent his daughter to the school. And there were, for want of a better word, a number of white South African dissidents there, dissident families. What I found quite disturbing, however, was that the senior and middle management seemed to be exclusively white. Extraordinary. Except for the Sesotho department, of course. I can't help thinking we'd have grabbed that as well if someone could speak the language really well. Despite the vast majority of teachers and students being black, and it felt to me as if we practiced a more insidious form of apartheid and one without an articulated doctrine that could be challenged. It was not apartheid that created the management structures. So what did? What was it? Can you just allow them to exist? As a school, it also suffered from the very common twin-tiered contractual standards that plague so many of our schools around the world. I don't know if you've got twin standards with teachers. It's a financial necessity, but it plagues many international schools. The steep learning curve of the first headship is quite remarkable, and I'm sure I made a good number of classic mistakes. But two things I did, quite possibly by chance, left an indelible impression upon me. Not anyone else necessarily, but certainly upon me. The first was to establish a base for a UK university, and this was 20 years ago. And it shall remain nameless in these sort of hallowed halls. It wasn't Cambridge, you can gather. And create a professional development program that enabled the teachers to undertake master's courses in situ. But it also enabled me to financially support teachers on local contracts. If you like to practice positive discrimination. I fear this may no longer be politically correct. I don't know. I use these terms, but I'm not sure where we are with words as they move on. The consequent impact upon staff morale and the subsequent opportunities it opened up for the local teachers changed the perceptions within the school entirely. While it did not and could not change a system that was effectively and for very financial, solid financial reasons, but it was institutionalized inequality. The program very visibly acknowledged, however, the intellectual equality of the teachers, and subsequent internal management changes also helped to redress the critical management imbalance. The impact on morale was very noticeable, and self-efficacy was more important to these teachers than any sort of salary increase. The second was to enlist the help and support and thereby raise the status of people that we often fail to see in a school. I'd like you to consider these people now as I talk about them. Before I get there, as a country, Lesotho suffers from significant brain drain to South Africa, which was, if anything, accelerated as a result of the regional political changes and the opportunities they presented. Young Basotho saw their own country as backward and of no value as they set their goal on the new South Africa. And my school seemed to be greatly assisting this brain drain by providing the qualifications to enable this to happen. This was not why the school was founded. This is the good bit that I liked. I had great fun with this. With the help of the cleaners, maintenance staff, and ground staff of the school, we built three rondavels, the round, thatched, mud-based homes of the Basotho, at the entrance to the school, and a museum that was located in the south of the country gave us historic artifacts to display. Together as a community, we created an art centre, a small museum, and a typical Basutu home. It did not stop the brain drain. It did not necessarily seem to bring more visitors to the school. As far as I know, it did not attract more students. The impact was more subtle than this. It demonstrated a commitment to the heritage of the Basutu. And above all, it provided the opportunity for the school to value both its employees and the indigenous community. We shared the experience as equals, and most of all, we laughed a lot. Humor is great for uniting people. We laughed a tremendous amount with the cleaners, the ground staff, the teachers, the students. It was the most wonderful, unifying experience that I could think of. Quite possibly, it left no mark on the community, but it left a huge mark on me. Was it a form of tokenism? You know, well, we'd build a little museum. It'd be easy to look at the finished product and think so, but as a process, it was a remarkable experience, and it was a tangible expression of what we valued as a school. I believe that both initiatives became examples of the school as leader. Issues were identified and the school took measures to address them, but not by the use of words, but by action. This was for me an important distinction in terms of leadership and one that I carried with me throughout my subsequent career. My second school could not have been more different. There it is. It's an old slide, and I'll explain why. I became head of Yokohama International School in 1997, which 2 years later celebrated its 75th anniversary. It was founded in the spirit of internationalism that followed the Peace of Versailles, and it opened its doors as an international school in 1924, just days after Geneva. And for a while, there was a big argument which one was the first international school in the world, because internationalism was something that really blossomed after Versailles. It was founded by a group of foreign businessmen led by a Swiss scientist called Paul Nipkow, who, according to his obituary, saw the opening of the school as one of his life's greatest achievements. When you realize, possibly his second greatest, was the invention of the Nipkow disc, which enabled early television to take off, you can see how important that would have been and how he valued education above a scientific invention like this. By the time I became a head, the school had morphed many times. That photograph is there because that's the first school, and it's flattened at the back. That was 1 year after the great Kanto earthquake that flattened all of Yokohama and Tokyo. So it literally grew out of ashes. It was a very significant school. It became a British-style boarding school for a while, then it became a Japanese civil defense station, and then it was bombed all over the place, and then a German refugee center as well. This is in Japan, and then back into an international school. If you look back on my professional life, I would refer to this period at Yokohama as my creative period. And that's a disaster for most people. You know, you put the word creative and head together, and it frightens the life out of most teachers. It's like sort of having an appendectomy, going into a hospital and say, oh, we've got a really creative surgeon for you. You know, most of us are petrified of a creative head. I understand that. Don't worry about it. I was there for 11 years, but for the sake of brevity, I'll talk about three things that we did in that school. The first one was that we looked at the community, and when someone came in and asked, could we use your hall for instrumental practice, they're professional musicians, I said, sure, provided you create an orchestra using the kids of the school, yourselves, other schools, and adults in our community. So they said, fine, and they did that. And then an American walked in, and we talk about serendipity, walked in, he was a koto player looking for a job. And I said, right, if you come in, you've got to teach all the children in the school in year three a Japanese instrument, the koto. I said, fine. And so every child in that school learned a Japanese instrument, subsequently a Western instrument if they wish, but stuck with the Japanese. And that developed into a koto program, and the school has won second place in all of Japan in koto competitions, which is remarkable because it's full of foreigners playing this, blonde-haired kids playing the koto. They've toured Australia, they've toured America, and they've got millions of yen in sponsorship, and every koto, and they've got about 20 donated by Japanese cultural organizations. Again, it was a question of trying to concentrate on the community that we were in and show respect for it. And by so doing, we enabled many students to really perform and grow in that culture. What better use of internationalism than that, I felt at the time. That has now developed into an international Japanese cultural center. The school has got that embedded now inside its own walls. The third thing we did was we talked about parents earlier on. I think parents are vital. If we look at the idea that parents are essential for the education of our children, then we've got to do something with them. So we started something called Bridging the Gap. The gap was the gap between the teachers and the parents. It was a conference. The conference is now, I think, in its 10th year. We bring the parents and the teachers together to listen to the same people. We move them together and they go to workshops together. At first, teachers are a little bit reluctant to do this because it left them exposed. Parents might know more than them. You know, we're very protective of what we know. However, it's a great success. And what that enabled us to do is change the school with the parents' blessing because they began to understand what we were trying to do. So we reached out and we brought the community in, both the parents and the Japanese community. And we weren't trying to be leaders. I want to get back to what I think leadership means in terms of a school. My third school was that one. Wow. 160 acres, 13th century castle. Sixth form college. 350 students from all over the world. Atlantic College, UWC, the original UWC. My office was under that tower somewhere. No, under this tower, right down the bottom. What a place. That was an extraordinary place. It was the first United World College, and it was founded out of a spirit of, you know, let's save the world in the Cold War, height of the Cold War. Let's not have our young people from behind the Iron Curtain fighting with our young people from NATO and then a nuclear holocaust destroying everyone. It was hoped that by bringing them together in a spirit of peace and then giving them testing, if not dangerous things to do together, then we would have a group of young people who could go out, not save the world, but become leaders who at least have a chance of making things different. What an iconic school. When I got there, what really upset me most was that we were very iconic and we did great things. We were leaders because there are other United World Colleges, but United World College is fairly kept self-contained. And we weren't actually connecting. I thought we should be able to connect more. Look at the resource. This is a wonderful resource. We should connect with other schools. So we started an associated school movement. Again, reaching out into the community. And we linked with a school in Birmingham and linked with a school in Liverpool and linked with a school in South Wales. The school in Birmingham had over 1,000 students and it was 97% Muslim. It staggered me. I had no idea. I've been overseas for years. An inner city school that was 97% Muslim. I'd never worked in such a homogeneous school ever. And the school in Liverpool was white, working class, 95%. How does that happen in a multicultural Britain? Staggered me. I don't know. I still don't know. However, what we did was we took a student from each of those schools and one from South Wales and brought them in as scholars. And the deal was that those schools had to link up with ours and link up with each other. And the students who were selected as scholars had to contribute. Because it was time that we reached out into the community of education and the community of other students. And again, this is something that attracts funding frequently. People see this as a good thing. And it worked extremely well. Really pleased with what happened. And then a gentleman walked through the door, a former UWC student, and he said, I'm trying to build a school in Cambodia. I said, that's interesting. Because I built a school in Cambodia. When I was at Yokohama International School, we started something called Schools Building Schools. And what we did, we built schools in other parts of Asia. And the teachers contributed out of their salaries. So every month money was taken from the teachers and the students were putting money into it and parents were coming along and they wanted stuff taken out of their salaries. When I left, I think there were about 5 schools that we built in Cambodia, in Tanzania, and in a number of places. It's still going strong. And when the tsunami hit Phuket, and I'm there now, it's funny how the world sort of, do you know, it's strange. But when the tsunami hit Phuket and it hit all of Southeast Asia, the person who was coordinating our schools, building schools, moved to Singapore and coordinated the building of schools, working with other international schools in the area of devastation. Isn't that wonderful? I think that was really good. And then this gentleman had walked through the door and said, I want to build a school in Cambodia. And I said, well, why stop at Cambodia? You should be building schools everywhere. He said, that's a good idea. I said, well, do it. He said, I'll do it. And it's now called United World Schools. And they're building schools. And they're linking with schools in this country. It's very easy to do. It's a wonderful system, and I think you can go on United World Schools, look it on the internet. I think you can go on YouTube and see the school playing Koto from Yokohama International School. There are many things on YouTube about that. So there, and schools building schools. And the IBO has now taken the schools building schools as schools to schools. It's now part of their program. In fact, I went to a conference in Singapore and said, you must have this. And they said, not at the moment. And then the tsunami hit, and then they took it on board. So, I'm getting there. Right, it brings me back once again to Phuket and my current school. It was one of the first of the British school franchises overseas because its original name many years ago was Dulwich College. And now, of course, you've got Harrows and Marlboroughs and Reptons and goodness knows what else all over the world and many Dulwich colleges. But that was the very first Dulwich College. And it broke with Dulwich. And then it started to nosedive. It's strange that all the schools I've been into have sort of reached their sell-by date. You know, I went in, they were all iconic. It's incredible because Machabeng was the first school that's multiracial in the middle of South Africa. Atlantic College was the first UWC. Yokohama was the second international school. And the one that I'm in now, that I'm going to put on the screen, is the one that was the first of the public school franchises. There it is. I know. It's not a model. It's really like that. And it looks like Dulwich. Fancy that. It's a disaster. Why build Dulwich in Asia? Because it doesn't work in a hot climate as it does in this country. However, that's the school. It's a fantastic school. I know. I'm a lucky man. I told you that. I'm very privileged. My office... I'm moving out of it to a little hole somewhere else, but my office is just there at the moment. You sort of look straight down the thing. It's very nice. And my house, where is it? Oh, that's my house. I know. The rewards of education. The rewards of education. Oh, dear me. All right. I've lost where I am now. I was laughing so much there. Here we go. Right. So what makes a school as leader? And do schools really need to come up with some special plan or novel idea to do this? I suppose there's always an opportunity to be among the first at something. The first multiracial secondary school within Southern Africa, the first international school of the modern era to be founded in Asia, the first United World College, and the first public school franchise in Asia. And there's no doubt that one interpretation or aspect of leadership does manifest itself in the idea of being first and then having mimicry. But we can't all do that. And that means only a handful of schools can ever be leaders. And that's nonsense. If leadership is only about novelty and innovation, boldly going where no one has boldly gone before, sort of Star Trek way, then we can almost all give up the idea of schools as leaders. However, in all my pioneering schools, and they were, and in varying degrees, I sensed a feeling of something lost. Something which in itself may have already been outmoded, that had once been unique but had now become commonplace, and how we hang on to our former glory. Too many schools are afraid to change because this is what they're good at. This is what we do well. This is why parents send their kids to the school. We don't want to change. And leadership is about change. You can't just hang on to the past. In a recent workshop exercise at my current school, I'm going on a long time. I thought I'd be over quicker. Are you all right? You don't need to jump up and down and do anything, do you? Okay. In a recent workshop exercise in my current school, I invited the teachers to interpret our school strapline. Did it mean that all our students would become leaders, that this was possible or even desirable? The end result was interesting, not least because no one had really considered the implications of the very visible claim that the school seemed to be making. No one had thought about it. We eventually arrived at the conclusion that an essential quality of leadership was virtue. There's that word, virtue. And that all students are, of course, capable of becoming good people. In this conclusion lies the very seed of leadership as far as I'm concerned. And I think the same is true for the school as leader. From my point of view, leadership is a moral position. The word popped up once or twice, moral. I think it's a moral position. Can't be avoided. And it's a process and not a product. In fact, it will always be ongoing. Leadership, we felt, begins with self. It is at heart about values and living a good life. A leader in some way or form impacts upon the consciousness of others, and I would suggest also this is often without that intention. A leader provokes some sort of action response in other people, and that response may be to emulate or indeed to follow. But how does that work within an institution? If I'm suggesting that living a good life is a moral basis of leadership, how does a school do this? Well, first of all, a school must have a well-articulated and clearly understood value system across the entire community. And I don't know if you do in your own schools, but you must identify your values and your value systems. This has been the basis upon which the school functions and it informs relationships. A school must clearly say what it means, and I make no apologies if this sounds a little trite. A school must be able to apply and understand the theory. It needs to know why it does things and to be able to defend or promote its position. An institution, and I cannot stress this enough, must attempt to put its values into discernible action. You can't just have values and forget they're there. You must do something with them. Individuals within a school will always do amazing things, but it's critical that the institution itself takes the initiative. This, I believe, must manifest itself in some way in a local sense before the global sense. People need to be able to relate to action and to understand its immediate impact, to join the dots between the language of values and the consequences of such belief in real time and with real people. We must stick our necks out and fight for what we believe in as an institution. In Phuket, and I'm going to end a little bit earlier because I put too many words down here. In Phuket, we built a learning center, once again, so that parents can come in and learn alongside the teachers. So the parents are coming in, trying to understand what we mean about education, where we are going, so that they are able to support what we do in the school. That learning center has opened up now to the Thai community, and we're working with the Ministry of Education to educate teachers about learning. We are actually starting a conference this year in Thai, in the Thai language, for Thai teachers and the Thai community, run by our Thai teachers. We're training them up to deliver. So we're becoming an international center for education. And in so doing, our reputation, I suppose, rises, and our position as school as leader increases in the community. Instead of just trying to isolate, we're trying to change. Instead of trying to just change ourselves, we're trying to influence others. Because at the very, very heart of what we do, school as leader is a moral position, and there is an imperative upon all of you as school leaders and on the schools to actually do something for others. Not your students doing something, not your teachers doing something, but as an institution to grasp the opportunity to make a difference in your communities. Some people will follow. Some people may not. The aim is not to become a leader in the heroic sense. The aim is to influence not only those around you, but the students that you work with. Students will not achieve anything unless they begin to feel valued for what they are, who they are. And if there's one thing that we have to do for all the students that we have in our schools, is to give them a sense of value and of being valued and an opportunity of being valuable to others. I will leave with a very, very brief story about my kids at Christmas time. I've got four of them. It's wonderful. Well, it used to be when they were little. They're big now. Terrible. Oh. Christmas tree, tinsel, presents, splash out on the kids. I had four under five, so you can imagine what it was like. They're all tiny little kids running around. And we bought them no end of things, and they were opening bags and all the stuff that they could open, you know, Lego sets and all the educational toys I could play with, all of that stuff. And they were on the whale of a time. And then Mummy said, "What about Daddy?" And immediately there was panic. Everybody stopped doing what they were doing. "What about Daddy?" And they went running around the Christmas tree. His presence here somewhere. They went scurrying about. They dropped everything. All these wonderful presents you spend a fortune on, they dropped them quickly until they found my present. And they brought it out, a little package like that. They brought it to me. And all of them were like that. "Go, God, Daddy." And I opened it up. I said, "These are the best pair of socks I've had ever." And their little faces lit up. "This is fun. I am going to put them on now." And they all stood around watching me. Because it was more important, and they got more out of giving than they did out of receiving. It's quite extraordinary. As human beings, we want to give. We must allow our children to have the opportunity to give. And if we do that, and if we ourselves give in our communities, then the world will be a much, much better place. And your children will be well equipped to survive the future. I'd like to thank Cambridge for letting me come in here. And you've been very indulgent. Thank you very much indeed.
This is a podcast from Cambridge International Examinations. For further information, visit cie.org.uk.